We are recording.
Hello, everyone. Today, I'm joined by one of our production managers, Thomas Kozakowski, and two of our R&D chemists, Liv Forbes and Madeline Ghazi. Today, we're going to continue with a comprehensive review of another one of our most popular resources, our trace analysis guide written by our founder, Dr. Paul Gaines. Be sure to check out previous episodes of Bench Boost to hear our team's thoughts on previous chapters from this guide and a complete review of each chapter of our ICP operations guide. Today, our team will be discussing Chapter 3 of the Trace Analysis Guide on sampling and subsampling. If you would like to follow along with us, then you can view the Trace Analysis Guide on our website at www.inorganicventures.com. All right, so Paul starts out this chapter discussing how sampling is not often really discussed when people are taking analytical chemistry courses. I think a lot of that's focused in more on the instrumentation and how to interpret interferences and that sort of thing. So he listed a lot of really good resources that our listeners can reference, and you know, he really gave a lot of good credit to those individuals for putting those resources together. I think it's needed and it's definitely helpful. So, you know, this episode, you know, just to give our listeners a heads up, we're not going to cover every aspect of sampling and subsampling. I think that would be probably a 20-hour podcast if we tried to attempt that. But really, the goal of this episode is to get people to start thinking about how their samples are sampled and subsampled. So I'll sort of toss this out to the group. We know, can someone describe our sampling approach for our production materials at Inorganic Ventures?
Yeah, sure. When we are taking, I guess, samples for our stock products, we usually take two retains, and they're not really big retains. We're dealing with solutions, so it's really almost guaranteed to be homogeneous. So we try to take one from the top and one from the bottom in case there really is a mixing issue. But then we'll test those with the same method, make sure they agree with each other. And if they don't, we'll know, hey, we might not have mixed it properly or something like that. But with solutions, it's pretty easy. This subject obviously is a little more vague because you could be talking about solids, but we don't do that here.
Exactly. So, you know, you mentioned during the production process, we pull two retains, but that's before a lot is tested and then bottled out into, you know, dozens, hundreds of bottles. Do we have a process for testing those bottled products as well?
Yeah, so when we're designing one for the first time, we call it a 10-sample homogeneity, but we actually do like a product homogeneity study to make sure when we make it the first time, it's completely homogeneous. And if it's not, we basically assign a value to the final uncertainty for a contribution to the uncertainty of the product, which in most cases is actually pretty close to zero. But yeah, we'll sample those, run them undiluted. So that's one of the things to get rid of some error in the process. We try to just look at the intensities, raw intensities, and no data manipulation. And we basically compare every bottle to each other. And then sample the bottles more than once, make sure we actually get reliable results within a bottle, and then kind of use a lot of math, a lot of statistics to make sure it is what it is. When you look at the ISO guides about homogeneity, it's very math heavy.
We're basically following the pattern that's one of the patterns that's set out in Guide 35 for our 10-sample homogeneity. And it's very labor intensive in terms of the statistics involved there. Like you said, Thomas, we look at undiluted products, so we have no manipulation of the material in there. And we're following the scheme the 10 samples and a certain order that's set out in the guide. I believe we do 1, 3, 5, 7, 9.
Mm-hmm. And then all the even numbers, and then we go count back from like 10 to 1.
Yeah, and then it's repeated. So you get randomized sampling as you're reading the samples also. So that's...
Yeah, that helps take out any instrument issues that you might have for maybe memory effects with your tubing or something like that. So it helps truly, I guess, randomize the approach and make sure that there's no bias from the method itself.
And we're also particularly careful with certain products that can have inherent inhomogeneities, like very low-level conductivities. Mm-hmm. They can change the five microsiemen material of one microsiemen material. They're very difficult to test. So we have very specific procedures in place for looking at the bottles. We do three retains from each of those, front, middle, and end. Mm-hmm. So some specific procedures for specific products.
And I know, Madeline, you're saying front, middle, and end during the packaging process,
Thank you, mm-hmm. Yes, during the packaging process, yeah.
That's great. In the next section, Paul sort of talks about developing a sampling plan. And this is pretty closely related to last week's episode of Bench Boost, where we talked about planning your project. So I'll toss this out to the group. How would you start if someone gave you a new sample or a new process to start sampling a product or a site or whatever?
I would look at how big it is. Mm-hmm. I know here at Inorganic Ventures we're providing you with a solution, but we didn't start with a solution. We did start with a solid of some kind, whether it's a salt, it could be a metal. But I will say, as time goes on, the quality of materials coming in aren't as good as they used to be. I know we've got certain lots of material. They may be the same lot number from a vendor. And as we test it and do trace metals on it, we see that it actually is not the same as the first time we tested it. So that's indicative of inhomogeneity. So how do you sample a large batch? It's very difficult. If you have the whole population and you're able to mix it in a solution, life is good. But when you've got a solid that's maybe you have a whole drum, one of those 55-gallon drums of solid, you would want to take and divide it into different parts. I think the guide says 30 is probably appropriate, but that could be hard. But then you would mix each little batch, take samples from it. It's very labor-intensive. But you do want to make your plan on the front end so that you don't waste time, you don't waste resources, and you actually get information that's useful. Hopefully you'll be able to mix it properly and you get the same result. But if you don't, how do you mitigate that? That's where your statistics will come in.
And sometimes you'd have to look at and say, okay, I have this large batch of starting material, a solid starting material. You mixed it. Mm-hmm. Say you did random stratified sampling mm-hmm. of that. That's a very specific way of doing that. And you still come out where you're seeing inhomogeneity. Well, mm-hmm. I think the one of the best things, you could remix it, and then you'd have to make decisions on the back end. Mm-hmm. Is there something, and this is getting into another area, but is there something inherent in that material that's causing it to be inhomogeneous? Are there oxides that are showing up in, mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. material? So those are some of the things you'd be seeing.
Yeah, and with real-world samples, I think the example we put on the website is something about an industrial site and how do we check for mercury and cadmium in the ground. So if you've got, a 20-acre plot, do you go to each acre and take one sample? Do you take multiple samples from each group? Subdividing is kind of important to kind of mitigate the statistics, make sure you get a full representative sample of that population you're looking at. Obviously, the risk goes up when you're dealing with environmental samples, but in our world, it's starting materials for your standards. And I think in the precious metals industry, a lot of those folks are reclaiming precious metals from like circuit boards. I saw a talk one time where they're talking about crushing them up, and how do you get a good idea of what metals are present? You'd have to crush it, mix it, make sure it's actually mixed well, and then take a sample. But of course, if you sample a different part of it, you might get a completely different result because maybe the heavy stuff makes it to one side of your mixing process and lighter stuff contains different metals.
And what comes to my mind also is, even though homogeneity testing is labor intensive in every part of these processes, it's so important because if you do see a sample of starting material that's inhomogeneous, you can be exposing some big problems that could cause you even worse problems if you ignored that down the road. So looking at the homogeneity of your starting material is very worthwhile.
Yeah. And I know, Thomas, you mentioned, you know, the precious metals community. You know, we usually attend at least one meeting put on by the International Precious Metals Institute, and they have a really good sampling and analytical committee group that meets up, I think, at least 3 or 4 times a year. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of great resources. I know that's probably what we use as sort of our, you know, our usual conference to attend to sort of catch up on some sampling techniques. But I would definitely recommend our listeners, you know, if you're in different industries, search out for if there are sampling groups. I think it'll help provide a lot of good insight to folks that might be struggling with this, because really your analysis is only as good as the sample that you start out with. So it's a huge component to actually getting an accurate result. In the next section, Paul talked about subsampling, and you know, this is, you know, you've pulled your sample, but you know, you may pull 50 grams of a sample, but that's not, you know, that's a little bit much to do a digestion on. So Liv, I'm going to kick this over to you. I know that we have some ground limits for how much of an aliquot we should pull, but what are your thoughts on, you know, how much of a sample you should use as part of a subsampling?
I think it's definitely important to use a decent amount, because you definitely don't want to use too little of your sample and not have good masses if you're doing gravimetric analysis. But you also, like you said, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to use 50 grams sometimes if that's what your sample is and you're doing, you know, an analysis that only uses a couple, like, micrograms or something of that, like, level. So I think it's definitely important to make sure that you're using enough sample that you're getting, like, good masses, and you're getting, you're not going to have a lot of uncertainty from, like, your prep of using so small of sample. But, again, you don't need to be excessive and use every single amount of sample that you get.
Yeah, so I guess it's just, how do you balance? Do you get a good representative sample of, you know, subsample of your sample? That can be a little difficult at times. I'll throw it out to the group. Anyone else have any other thoughts?
Yeah, I know when it comes to sampling, I know as a CRM producer, I guess it's ISO 17034 now. It used to be GUID. They actually tell us we have to specify on our certificate what's a minimum sample size that you take from our bottles. And we've, of course, done studies on that. And I believe we say it's 0.2 mils or grams.
Yeah.
You have to get a good enough number on your balance to be reliable. So that's, I think, where the biggest issue is here. Do you get a big enough sample that you can actually test it reliably and measure it reliably with a good uncertainty?
And I know also in this section, Paul mentioned, and I thought, you know, this was a great callback, you know, Liv, especially you talked about last week, how important it is to try to avoid adding contamination as part of your process. You have to worry about that as with sampling as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. So whatever you're collecting your sample in, whatever materials you're using if you're weighing a solid on a weighboat, you want to make sure, you know, your weighboats are clean, your materials are clean that you're using. If you're trying not to touch anything with your gloves, because those have a lot of contaminants on them, it's really important to make sure that you are handling your samples as little as possible and using really clean materials. And if you're putting them into solution, you want to make sure you're using clean water and clean acids. Whatever you're using, you want to make sure it's as clean as possible so you're not introducing any contaminants into your sample as well.
Perfect. Yeah, I know if you're grinding, or, you know, you have to sieve your samples, a lot of times that has some sort of metal as component as part of it, and that's a good place to introduce a large amount of contamination if you're not careful and making sure things are cleaned, or just cross contamination from sample to sample. So I think it's a really good opportunity to look out for that.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad idea either to, especially if you're filtering your samples, or like you said, running them through like a sieve or something, to try to do some sort of study beforehand and see what kind of contaminants you might be getting out of those materials as well, if you're not sure.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. That kind of brings to the really the last point that I had, you know, for this chapter. Paul, outlined a lot of different examples that I would definitely recommend our listeners go through and read. But just as a general, you know, sort of tips and advice, how would you guys, you know, what advice would you give to our listeners on how to avoid contamination during the sampling process?
If you're sampling liquids, I would definitely go with low density polyethylene bottles. Teflon if you absolutely have to, but those are very expensive. The LDPE is so much cheaper, just as clean, not hard to clean if it's dirty. Just make sure you acidify your samples so you don't have any loss of elements when you're testing on your ICP, of course.
And going along with that, Thomas, minimizing the any kind of apparatus that you're going to use to take your sample, pipette tips. How clean are your pipette tips? You know, so if you can pour, like you're talking, an aqueous sample, if you can pour your sample from directly from your larger vessel into your LDPE bottle, then you're better off. Then you have one less possibility of contamination in there.
Yeah, and when you go to solids, I mean, our example was testing basically soil, so I guess don't use a metal shovel. I mean, those are things that you wouldn't think of, but it might be important for your analysis. Why is there so much more metal content in this in the soil sample? Well, it might have been what you dug it up with.
True. All right. Well, we hope you found this conversation helpful. If you have any questions, please contact us at ivyignite@inorganicventures.com. Ignite membership provides you with unlimited access to video courses, downloadable resources, community forums, and so much more. Join us next week as we review chapters 4 and 5 of the Trace Analysis Guide, where our team will discuss an intro to sample prep and container materials. We'll hope you join us then and have a fantastic week. Thanks.